Sarah, do we be able to hear me okay in that? Can you hear okay in that?
Yes.
It's a great pleasure for me to be back at the Smithsonian and back in Washington. Being here makes me reflect on the first time that I took an overnight trip away from home. As a teenager, when I was 16 years old, my parents put me on the train. I came to Washington for a meeting of the Junior Red Cross, and I recall my excitement of coming to Washington then, and undoubtedly, in retrospect, now that I'm a parent of teenagers, my parents' angst at putting me on the train, my father provided me with some pre-signed traveler's checks, and I called collect to confirm that I had arrived and I was getting on the train on the way back. But Washington was a wonderful city for my travel career to begin in. When I've been on radio programs in the last week, starting to launch the new book, I'm often asked, why do you write? And the answer is simple. I write because what I choose to write about is the most fascinating questions, I think some of the most important questions, and by writing about them, subjects that initially I was not an expert on, I get a chance to talk with the experts, to learn from them, to go and visit the places, to explain things to myself as clearly as I can, and then to explain things to other people, to the public, as clearly as I can, in the same language in which I have explained things to myself. All of us, I think, already as teenagers, are fascinated by questions of ancient societies that collapsed, leaving behind mysteries and ruins, cities covered up by jungle, like the Mayan cities, or abandoned skyscrapers, like the Anasazi ruins in the U.S. Southwest. And we ask ourselves, why do they collapse? Or why do they build these great cities in a place that seems barely habitable today, like the Southwest or the jungle? And why, having gone to all this effort to build these cities, did they then abandon them? So this is something certainly that fascinated me as a teenager, and I think all of us get fascinated when we see the pictures of the Mayan cities and East Rylan statues and Anasazi cities. Therefore, my book started out as an attempt, finally, after 50 years, to address these questions that have fascinated me since my teens. What's the explanation behind these romantic mysteries? And the book contains then a chapter on the collapse of East Rylan society with its great stone statues eventually overthrown by the islanders themselves, and the collapse of the Maya civilization in the Yucatan, the quintessential civilization with cities overgrown by jungle, the disappearance of the ancient Polynesian settlements of Pitcairn Island and Henderson Island in the Southwest Pacific, even before the mutineers arrived, or close at hand, the collapse of the Anasazi in our Southwest, and then culturally close at hand to Europeans, the collapse of the European society, the Vikings, the Norse, who emigrated to Greenland around AD 1000 and erected there a European society, and eventually ended up all dead. So, there are these five chapters on these archaeological mysteries, trying to understand the reasons for these collapses. As I got into the subject, I realized, though, that there was a lot more in this than romantic mysteries, because it's not the case that all societies in the past were doomed to collapse. There were many societies in many parts of the world where complex societies had been going on for thousands of years without any signs of collapse. For example, Japan, 14,000 years of virtual continuity. Iceland, the icelanders surviving in a difficult environment. The New Guinea Islands, where I do my field work, 46,000 years of human occupation. The islands of Java and Tikapia in the Southwest Pacific. So there are not only failures, there are also successes of human societies in the past. Therefore, we've got a challenging intellectual problem to understand why some societies failed or collapsed in the extreme case with everybody ending up dead, while other societies were succeeding. What was it? What was the secret of the societies that solved their problems? And what were the shortcomings of the societies that failed to solve their problems? But then finally I realized that this is not going to be a book just about the past, because in the modern world too, there are societies that seem to be succeeding, and there are societies that have already failed, that have collapsed to the point where there's no longer state government, as in Somalia, and coming close to that in Haiti. And there are societies that are at risk of collapse. Do the causes of success and failure of the past also play out in the modern world, or perhaps of greater practical importance? What can we learn from past societies that would help us confront our problems today? Can we learn from the past something that will help us not ending up with the fate of the Maya, so that 200 years from now, people do not come, if there are people, people do not come to Washington and look at the rusting skyscrapers and say, my God, why do they build in such a place, and why do they abandon the Emerald City? Therefore, the book is also about modern societies, running the spectrum of first world to third world, and running the spectrum from sad tragedies up to modern success worlds. I begin the book with Montana, seemingly the most pristine of the lower 48 states and the richest country in the world. Montana, a society that one would think would be largely immune to environmental problems. Montana is the state in which my wife and kids and I have been spending parts of our vacations for the last 7 years that I've been visiting Montana for 51 years. But when you scratch the surface of Montana, you find that Montana suffers from all the environmental problems shared with the rest of the world. Problems of forest management and water and soils and population of toxic chemicals and so on. Among the saddest chapters of the book, there's a chapter on the African country of Rwanda, which solved its population problems and its soil erosion and its deforestation problems in a grisly way in 1994 when 6 million Rwandans killed 1 million Rwandans. That's a worst case scenario. There's also the island of Hispaniola in the Caribbean, that big island next to Cuba, which is almost a controlled experiment performed by scientists with a test tube into one of which you pour one solution, the other the other. On the Caribbean island of Hispaniola, there's a line down the middle, and the west side of the line is brown and is one of the poorest countries in the world, and the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere, Haiti. And the east side of the line is green, it's the Dominican Republic. Yes, a third world country, but on a capital basis, 8 times richer than Haiti, and with 30% of its land still covered with forest, with one of the two most comprehensive natural reserve systems in the New World, whereas Haiti is 99% deforested. And as a result, a hurricane struck Hispaniola a year or two ago. On the Haitian side, with no forest, pulled back the soil, there were landslides, massive mudslides, and 3,000 Haitians got killed, whereas on the Dominican side, with much of the forest attack, there were not those mudslides, controlled experiment. There's also a chapter on the world's largest country, China. The environmental populations of China affect 1 million, 300 million people, but also because China is so huge and its gases go out into the same atmosphere as the rest of the world, and it imports its timber from the same tropical timber sources as the rest of the world. China also has a big impact on the world. And then there's a chapter on Australia, the first world society in the most fragile environment with the most infertile soils and the lowest rainfall. But Australia is also the first world society today considering the most radical solutions to its problems of environmental population. Those then are the selection of past and modern societies that I'll discuss. As I began to think about these problems of societal success or failure, I realized that I could not come up with a one-factor explanation for success or failure. And I knew that I would be doing nobody in favor if I came up with a comprehensive 83 factor explanation that thought of everything possible. And so I ended up with a 5-point framework, a checklist of 5 factors that I go over in trying to understand, in the case of any particular society, why it collapsed or succeeded. In no particular order, my 5-point framework includes human environmental impacts. Many human societies committed ecological suicide, destroying themselves by destroying the resources on which they depended, either the water resources or the soil resources or the forest resources or the biological resources or the fisheries resources. And one of the things that archaeologists have learned in the past couple of decades is that in the case of most of these collapses of ancient societies that I mentioned, the Maya, the Anasazi, these Brahmins, and so on, there was a big environmental component. Humans inadvertently hammering away at their resources until they had knocked out the underpinnings on which they themselves rested. So, item number one of my checklist, human environmental impacts. Inadvertent, but sometimes suicidal. Item number two, climate change. Climate is changing today, it's getting warmer due to especially human causes, but climate is changing the past. In the past, climate has gotten colder, or it's gotten warmer, or it's gotten drier, or it's gotten wetter. And climate change interacts with human environmental impacts. A society that is hammering its environment may be able to get away with it as long as the climate is in its favor. And then it collapses when the climate turns against it, as in the case of the drought that was the last war for the world. Or conversely, a climate change that is harmful for society. A society may be able to ride through as long as it has not damaged its environment too much. So human environmental impacts interact with climate change. Then the third item on my checklist is enemies. Most societies have neighbors, and some of those neighbors at some times are enemies. And when a society is strong, they may be able to hold off its enemies, and then when it gets weaker, that's when the enemies walk in on it. That means that it's often difficult to figure out whether the fundamental cause of the collapse was the enemies themselves, or whether the enemies were just taking advantage of a society weakened for fundamentally different reasons. So, for example, there's been a long-standing ongoing debate about the fall of the Western Roman Empire and the role of barbarians. There was no doubt that the barbarians invaded the Western Roman Empire. And the conventional date for the end of the Western Roman Empire is associated with the barbarian takeover of Rome. But there is still an unresolved question. Were the barbarians the fundamental cause or just the last straw for the Roman Empire? Was it the case that Rome had gotten weakened internally because of its own political and economic and military problems? And there were always those barbarians out there, and they simply took advantage of Rome's weakness to deliver the final blow? Or was the fundamental cause of the fall of the Roman Empire something different from the barbarians? Rome was always dealing with its economic and political problems, but the barbarians either got more numerous because of something going on in Central Asia, or the barbarians developed improved technology and military strength, and so the fundamental cause was the barbarians. A similar question, as we'll see, arises with the fall of the Greenland Norse. In their disappearance, enemies, namely the Inuit and Eskimos, played a role. Then there's also the fourth item on my checklist, the issue of friends. Again, every society with neighbors has friendly trade partners, but a society that's managing its own environment perfectly well may be undone if its trade partners on whom it depends collapse. And this is something that Americans are well aware of from the 1973-74 Gulf oil crisis, when the American economy got into severe difficulties as a result of the economic and ecological and political instabilities of countries out there supplying us with essential resources. That turns out to have been the case with a couple of Polynesian islands, pre-Bouncing Mutiny, Pitcairn and Henderson, who were done in not by their own environmental problems, but by the collapse of their trade partner, Nanuatu. So those are the first four items on my checklist. And then the last item, of course, is how does a society respond to all these problems? Does a society perceive and try to solve the problems, and if so, does it succeed? That's to say, society's political, economic, cultural, and social responses to its problems. That's my five-item checklist that I apply to each society. Just to give you a flavor of these mystery collapses, let me tell you briefly the story of the collapse of the Polynesian Society of East Rota.